Hi, I'm Rob, and this is another episode of Rewind and Review. As always, I'm joined by a man who bows to no one, my co-host, Jason.
You know, I was gonna give you my best like Gollum impression, but I'm not.
You could call me your precious, but you don't have to do that. That's fine.
You are my precious.
Oh, that's very nice of you. That's very nice. So anyway, everyone, welcome to Rewind and Review. This is a retrospective podcast where we have a look at an existing property from the past, delve into its legacy, discuss how it's held up over time, and even give our own personal experiences. Did we watch it as a kid or sometime later in our lives?
This episode of Rewind and Review will look at a film that celebrated its 20th anniversary in December 2023. We are obviously running a little bit late. Get off our back about it. And it is the third installment of one of the greatest film franchises ever to be produced. Not my opinion, but no, look, I give it value. I appreciate it muchly.
I think it certainly is. So get ready to finish this epic journey, because we have done the first two already. We're going to throw some unwanted jewelry into a volcano. We're going to charge towards battle on horseback while screaming death, and by eating some well-deserved salted pork on a field of victory as we make our way back to the year 2003.
Swinging 60s, here I come, baby, yeah!
Go back to then.
When?
Now.
Ooh, that's how it always starts.
There's definitely a very slim chance we'll survive.
The year when a clownfish touched a butt. The Matrix reloaded and then revolved, and then the world saw Johnny Depp become a drunken pirate. All these films were successful in their own right, and some were better than others, but none were as epic in scope as today's film, The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King.
Of course, if you have not yet checked out this movie, or dare I say film, this film, please do so first, as we will be talking spoilers. And if you haven't seen this movie yet, it has been 20 years.
Yes.
So if you've got a spare 4 hours, get it done.
What have you been doing? Bloody hell. All right. So this film, directed by Peter Jackson, is based on the fantasy novel series by J.R.R. Tolkien. Lord of the Rings, Return of the King is the third entry into the epic fantasy trilogy that defined a genre and concluded the long journey through Tolkien's Middle Earth.
Or New Zealand. they look the same. The movie picks up immediately following the events of the second film, The Two Towers, and continues the stories of various members of the Fellowship and their allies as they continue on their quest to destroy the One Ring and save Middle Earth from the coming darkness of war.
Mm-hmm. Return of the King sets the stage for the final confrontation between the forces of good and evil, led by the heir to the throne of Gondor, Aragorn, played by Viggo Mortensen, and his allies Gandalf the Wizard, played by Sir Ian McKellen, Elf Legolas, played by Orlando Bloom, Dwarf Gimli, played by John Rhys-Davies, alongside the adorable hobbits, Merry, played by Dominic Monaghan, and Pippin, played by Billy Boyd, and of course the King of Rohan, Theoden, played by Bernard Hill.
Elsewhere, Hobbits Frodo is played by Elijah Wood, and Sam, once again, Sean Austin, continue their journey through the evil land of Mordor, guided by the scheming Gollum, or Sméagol, however he's feeling when you catch him on a good day, who's played very funly with by Andy Serkis, I don't know what I'm saying, in their quest to destroy the One Ring in the molten pit of Mount Doom.
Yes.
Yes. So, I do take this movie seriously. I'm
can I say, right? So this movie, like, or usually I'll go, Jason, tell me about your experience, but I need to say straight up, right? I'm gonna throw myself in here quickly. So I love this movie. You already know that.
You've watched
about
it.
I've watched this movie a couple of times. in our in the Fellowship of the Ring and the Two Towers reviews, like, I gush about this. I gush about like this trilogy. I just fucking love it, right? But when I'm reading the plot summary that we put here, it just sounds crazy. It's so crazy and nerdy and
it's fantasy.
It's fantasy. And you know what? It's probably one of the only fantasy properties. Like we said in the intro there, that it defines like the genre, but like it's set a benchmark that nothing else really kind of met. And it is really the only real property that I like that's fantasy. But anyway, so my experience, just so everyone knows, is I watched this a lot of the times. I watched it twice in cinemas. In 2003, I graduated high school. So I was a 17-year-old young man, and I chose to watch this twice in theaters. Hell yes. I still get goosebumps listening to the score, watching some of those amazing scenes we're going to talk about. Oh, goddamn, it's great. Jason, have you seen this movie?
Mate, in 2003, I started high school. I'm not even joking. Look, I didn't see this in cinemas. And as we've spoken about these movies before, like The Lord of the Rings was not a thing for me. The fantasy genre isn't what I gravitate towards, especially like the real full on. That's what this is. I had seen the first two, but like just didn't really watch them to the level that I was really required to absorb it. It wasn't until my wife like basically forced me and was like, look, we're going to do it. We're going to watch them. And then, we watched the extended versions of all three of them. Mm. Surprisingly, like the extended version, is the only version I've seen of Return of the King. I've never actually bothered to watch the theatrical version. So I literally know no different. It's the only, and our reviews that we've been doing, just the extended straight, we have done the extended ones. So that's where we're at. I've seen it a total of 3 times, this movie. I worked out the other day. I was like, nope.
And how do you
this
feel?
This is my third viewing.
How do you feel about that?
How do I feel? Yeah. Well, I mean, we've got a whole episode devoted to that.
Feel adequate? It's an adequate amount of viewing for your life, or do you feel like you might revisit this one again?
I mean, with my wife, I think we will be revisiting it again and again multiple times until we die or she leaves me. Either way, whatever happens first. But look, I definitely have. I've grown such an appreciation for the craft and what these films bring. Like this really is, and you said it, like peak fantasy genre. Like,
yeah,
something crazy happened when this movie came out, or you know, when this movie, you know, capped the trilogy.
Mm.
It was really like a peak of the fantasy genre in cinema.
Yeah,
and if you look at pretty much what this movie did. What this film did, I feel like it deserves that word. Like what this film did, it's like everyone else just went, well, we ain't going to top that. So what's the point in trying to do another fantasy? I mean, that's obviously a bit of hyperbole there. Obviously there have been other fantasy ones, but there haven't been anything to this scale, this level.
Yeah.
Like this 4-hour epic is pretty much that. It's epic. And look, I'm showing my hand a little bit here, but it is crazy. Look, we'll get into stuff, and there's things that, like, this movie is, it's just over 20 years old, right? Like, it literally turned 20 at the end of last year.
Yes.
There's some special effects in this, and this was a time where it was like, hey, look, CGI exists, and we can use it, and we can use a lot of it. There's effects in this that it's like, when you're watching it, especially when you're watching it, like, high quality Blu-ray level or 4K, whatever, you're like, yeah, look, some stuff looks a little bit crummy. It's not that much though, but there are some bits, you know, like Legolas like jumping up onto one of those
elephant things,
whatever they are,
yeah,
and it's like, oh yeah, that's so cartoon looking,
yeah,
but there's also so much that looks fantastic, brilliant. And again, we will get into all of the special effects stuff and all that, but anyway, that's my summary of I guess, as you know, like even as of today, like how present Lord of the Rings is in my life, even though I'm not the hugest fan, like my wife today got a Lord of the Rings tattoo of all things. Literally, yes.
What'd she get?
I think it's that like elf, like the elven, like
Scritch,
logo thingy. I don't know. You message her and ask her. I don't know.
I'll have to ask her because I'm. that's wicked. Good on you. That's great. Good on you, Beck. That's great. I do not have. I always toyed with the idea of actually getting like the Elvis script, like my name and my wife's name as well, like kind of around my arm, because I actually taught when I was young, like not younger, when I first met Laura. I actually had already learnt how to write that script, believe it or not. Like, that's how much I like this fucking movie.
That's like the fantasy equivalent of like learning Klingon. That's,
I think
that's
it
like
is
the nerdiest
think,
thing.
Genuinely, I think it is. But you have to admit. So you know the text that's on that like the Elvish text that's on the ring.
Yeah,
it's very pretty. It's very like elegant and stuff. And the thing is, the way that Tolkien, you know, the amount of world building that he did with when he created this, you know, the story, he created a whole new language, like written and, you know, dialect, verbal as well. And it's just like, it's all there for the consuming. It's quite amazing. Anyway, what I was going to say, by the way, you know how I was saying this define a genre. The only other thing I can think that's comparable, of course, probably be like Game of Thrones, right? But that in itself is it's not the same either, you know, like it's just one that, you know, obviously different medium, TV and stuff like that. But this because it's a journey and you're really invested in these characters and how they travel and, you know, their relationships with each other. I think the Game of Thrones it just tells a story in a different way that isn't as impactful as this. So I still even think that even with something as huge as that, this still has, you know, takes the hat for the genre, I reckon anyway. But let's talk.
I think
with
Game of Thrones, it can delve into like the drama side of the characters and the relationships. And obviously you've got like the political side of things and all of that, but it is, you know, I think as a long form thing, you have that drama whereas these, even though, you know, you still have, you know, drama between characters and relationships and interactions, mm-hmm. good versus evil, you know, all of that stuff. But then at the core of this, it really, it allows its action and its adventure elements to shine.
Mm. Yeah.
So I think, obviously there's comparisons to something like a Game of Thrones or whatever, but I think the handling it like of it all and like what it ends up delivering, like there's more of a sense of fun and adventure and a charm. And then you've got characters like the hobbits that bring a different kind of sensibility to the world that you're in. You're just like, this is so goofy and fun and cheeky. Yeah. And it's like, it's epic, but then we're having a good time.
It's epic in scale, but it's intimate in its way that it's performed, you know, the way that the characters, you know, are delivered. Like, they're personal. Like, you feel like you know these characters.
Yeah, I think by the end of it, and I don't think you get this from Game of Thrones, but I think by the end of, like, Lord of the Rings, you're like, I've just spent, like, 12 hours hanging out with some friends.
Yeah.
You know, like...
Yeah, and when you're on board and you know how... I mean, you know, everyone kind of talks about how there's like a million endings for this movie, right?
Why won't it end? It just keeps fading to black.
But if you think about it, each of those endings is a different, like it's an ending for a component of the story that's being told. Like you've got, you know, when you've got Frodo in the bed in Rivendell and they're all coming in, you know, one by one, that's the ending for the Fellowship. But then it's them coming back together and then that's it. When you've got them... on the roof bowing to, you know, and Aragorn's getting crowned and you're bowing to no one, you bow to no one, that's the ending for Gondor and the world, like, so that closes off the world story. Yeah. And then when they're, you know, catching the boats at the Grey Havens and moving on, that's Bilbo and Frodo's ending, because he's no longer connected to the world. Like, he got rid of the ring, but it's not for him, it's for the rest of the people. Like, so like yeah
oh,
like just the
Sam's
way that they,
ending and
yeah, yeah Sam has his own ending and yeah it's just I when people say that, you know, there's too many endings on this bloody thing, it's like no you've got to look at how it's you know, these are all different journeys, and, look, and you're saying goodbye to every component of the story, including the world, including, you know, the journey and then the individual characters, you know.
Hey, look, I've been guilty of taking that stance as well and being like, you know, almost like it's a bit of a piss take, like, oh, the movie ends like six times.
It's very indulgent, I'll
black,
say
but
that.
It just keeps coming. But when you watch it, and again, like you said, like when you're invested in these characters and you've gone on this journey, you've watched all the extended cuts because you're an idiot, and you get to this end and it's like, no, like, yeah, let this wrap up and let it, like, it's earned it. We've come this far. Why would you want it to just snap to black, roll credits? I don't know. And if anything, you know what? I don't know if this is on the standard version, but watching the credits, they go for 20 minutes. The credits go for 20 minutes, and there's 10 minutes of, like, the fan club names or something. Oh, like, this cannot go for 10 more minutes.
I don't think that was in the theatrical. But how good are the credits when you think of it? Like, all of, like, the they're like hand drawn portraits of the characters. Kind of like the Avengers, like Endgame credits, you know? Like
I was gonna make the comparison, but then I was like, if it, like, Lord of the Rings is first, so I'm like,
yeah, Lord of the Rings did it first. That's right. Yeah.
Here are our stars of the of this. Yeah, no, it's great.
It is. Oh, it's just, Look, obviously you're going to have to put up with me gushing about a lot of stuff on this, but let's just talk about the footprint.
Mate, I'm always up for you gushing. It's all good. Gush away. Have to gush out.
Well, we'll get rid of some of the, just the housekeeping on this stuff. We already talked, you know, in our other two, you know, at Fellowship of the Ring and Two Towers episodes about, you know, things like, you know, the budgets and all that. But just to recap, you know, so this particular film was $94 million. So the trilogy cost $281 to make. This particular element, about $94 mil. But its box office is $1.15 billion, and the trilogy made $3 billion. So it's our highest grossing film in 2003. It was the second film in history to reach 1 billion, only behind Titanic. So this was obviously, 2003. There wasn't many billion-dollar bloody films, but yeah, it's the second one of all time, you know, in all of history to reach that milestone. I think it's, and, you know, we've got, well, it's not, that's not the only achievement that's like kind of history worthy either. You know, like you've got, you know, well, when we start to talk things like awards and stuff, like just how celebrated this bloody movie is, you know, it's, what was it? What do we have here? It won 258 awards out of 337 nominations. And out of that, nominated for 11 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and all that. And it won them all. Like, bloody hell. It's just a brilliant movie.
I remember thinking, and this is back when I was obviously less educated, mature, and just didn't know shit, to have a fantasy film win, like, the Best Picture at the Oscars, like, it felt like a game changer. It was like, what? Like, oh, a movie like this can win Best Picture? Like, what is going on? And it kind of opened the floodgates for, like, hey, look, genre films have a standing, like, and I at the same time, like, you can make a high quality
genre
film,
yeah,
with legitimate, like, credentials to it, and within a genre, like, you know, whether it's sci-fi, fantasy,
I reckon,
the comic book genre, like, it can happen.
I would expect you know what, because it was 20 years ago, I would have probably expected a few more, you know, like, kind of standout awards since then, but it is kind of really standalone when you think about it. Like, not many genre films have, you know, had this same, not, I mean, you're never going to have the same kind of success, because it was a cultural movement at the time as well. Like, I remember very clearly, I was an adult, you know, well, just finished high school. Like, I did not, when it got nominated for 11 Academy Awards and it won them all, I wasn't expecting it, and I was into it, you know, like, I think it just kind of came out of, it was just more successful than anyone would have even considered, you know? And I think part of it is because it, you know, you had three films released consecutively pretty much on Boxing Day every year. Like, it just had so much momentum behind it. Like it was just, it captured the cult, the zeitgeist and the, and yes, the world's perspectives like so well, just did it so well. And it was a well-made movie. So it was, you know, deserving of those awards. But I think just that hype train has really, really pushed it to a level that I don't think it's even possible to emulate ever again, you know? So now, you know, it's one thing to have heaps of obviously awards and everything, but I mean, clearly critics have got an opinion on this as well. So right now, if you're interested, Jason, I guess, Rotten Tomatoes has this at 94%. It's an average of 8.7 out of 10. Surprisingly, only 277 reviews out of 7 billion people in the world. Only 277 people have reviewed it. Interesting. Metacritic gives it 94 out of 100 based on 41 reviews, citing universal acclaim. Cinema score, it's an A-plus grade. What a surprise, which is actually an upgrade from The Two Towers, which was an A, and The Fellowship of the Ring, which was an A-. So it just goes on.
And did they get Best Picture awards? No.
No.
So there we go.
So they did not, because they were not the Best Picture.
They were not A-plus.
According to our cinema score, anyway. Now, Roger Ebert, he gave the film 3.5 stars out of 4, because he's a prick. Now, he's saying... where's the other half of it? Anyway, so he was saying it's such a crowning achievement, such a visionary use of all the tools of special effects, such a pure spectacle that it can be enjoyed even by those who have not seen the first two films. That's interesting to me because I don't necessarily agree with that because I think to enjoy this movie, you really do have to be familiar with these characters. Yeah, I think you have to be on that journey. So, I mean, who am I to debate Mr. Roger Ebert? But anyway, so talking about the entire trilogy, Ebert said that he admired it more as a whole than in its parts. So why did you say the first thing, Roger? But anyway, and that the Return of the King certified the Lord of the Rings as a work of bold ambition in a time of cinematic timidity. Oh, my goodness, I can't pronounce it. Jason, say that word for me.
Cinematic timidity?
Timidity.
Yeah, just say with confidence. What have I told you? Go full steam.
So ultimately what you need to really acknowledge is, you know, financially successful film. Its legacy is profound. You know, its impact culturally, but, you know, also it's critically acclaimed, both by audiences and, like, you know, professional critics as well. Just want to reflect on the franchise as a whole as well. We did touch on this on our other reviews. We don't need to go into too much detail. But, you know, you've got the Hobbit trilogy as well as, you know, the three movies in this franchise, this trilogy that, you know, Return of the King is kind of finishing. But you've also got the Rings of Power Amazon Prime series, which is, you know, that is the most current, you know, iteration within this world. Now, they're not, it's not officially linked to it, but.
And since we did our Two Towers review, which was obviously the previous Rewind review, Lord of the Rings episode, this hadn't come out yet, had it?
It had not. No, it was coming out that year, was it? Yeah. And I actually read the reason why I wanted to point out the series. I don't need to talk about the Hobbit movies. They're brilliant. I love them as well, but they're a different thing. Maybe one day we'll review
them. We don't need to talk about the Hobbit movies.
But I actually think they're completely underrated so strongly, but that's just me. I think I have a bias, Jason. But the Rings of Power, I don't think that's actually overrated. I'm not as big a fan of that as I was hoping to be. But it's actually coming out. The second season is coming out in this year, in 2024, which I think was only confirmed on a Collider post that I saw on Instagram. For me, only a couple of days ago, I saw that. So
is that a fact? Hey, yeah. All right.
And I think
I'll tell you, the wife and I, we're very, very delayed. We're going to check out the Rings of Power now that I've finally done my rewatch of Return of the King. So we'll get onto that. So unfortunately, I've got no comments to say on the show yet, but yeah, like you, I've heard a few mixed things about it. Like, starts strong, kind of falls off by the second episode. And then from there, it's a bit of a mixed bag.
Now, what I'd say is it just changed. My expectation might have been really, really high, but it's actually a great TV show. So I think maybe if you're not as passionate, so I think Beck's going to be screwed, right? Because she will be like me. She'll have... she'll be very, very, very into it. Now, I did like it. I just wish it was connected to the movie universe that we've seen and we love.
It's not Lord of the Rings trilogy.
But it's not connected. It's not really, like, there's little nods and you can tell that they're purposefully linking it. And now that I didn't realize that you guys hadn't seen it, so I won't spoil anything for you.
But it's set in a completely different time, isn't it? Like, isn't it like
thousands of years earlier. But it was very unclear whether or not it's set in the same continuity as the movies. And I think they're moving towards that direction, but they didn't want to commit to it. So it kind of is and kind of isn't. Beck will, you will definitely notice links, but they're there for, like, they're little Easter eggs, but I don't think they're a commitment. So you'll find,
she'll guide me through it. She'll guide me through it and let me know.
I think you'll love it. I mean, it's a beautifully, beautiful show. Like, it just looks stunning.
Yeah. I'll be honest. Do you know what else we need to bloody catch up on? I've only seen the first Hobbit movie. So
what? Oh my gosh. Oh.
Did we not say at the top, this isn't my genre? These aren't my movies.
Yeah, I just thought.
but that's the, I'm primed for it. Like, again, like, especially rewatching Return of the King again. And just this is my legacy of Lord of the Rings. the Lord of the Rings stamp in my life. Like, yeah, look, I'm primed for it. Let's get into The Hobbit. Not us. Not like rewind and review and all that. Like, I'll do that in my personal time. I will get done.
I'd join you for a marathon, mate, but that's another conversation. The last little thing I wanted to talk about, just around the franchise element for this, before we just kind of talk more about the movie itself. But you know, you mentioned at the top, these reviews that we've done for this trilogy have been for the extended edition, and I wanted to define that just a little bit. So with the extended editions that we're talking about for this particular for Return of the King, this one had 50 minutes of new material compared to the theatrical. I won't say all the scenes in it, but there's quite a lot. But some of them are just extensions of what is in the theatrical, and some of them are completely standalone scenes. Now, what I think I mentioned at the top, but what I will very much will point out as we go, is I do think if you are watching this movie for the first time or you're not as familiar with it, the theatrical version, I think, is actually the best version you could be watching. The extended one is one that you would watch once you're familiar with the movie, really.
Whoops.
Yeah, and so it's interesting with your like, because I think if you were to watch the theatrical cut, I think you would actually probably enjoy it.
I would have a spare more. 55 minutes or whatever it is.
Yeah, well, so yeah, good. You'd be able to get an earlier night, that's for sure. But I think that's just my perspective, and I've heard that from other reviews and things as well, like shared. It's the way that Peter Jackson edited the theatrical version, there's really good reasons why this extra stuff wasn't in there. It's good content. It really is good. Like, it adds to the movie. It expands on the movie, but when you're watching it for the first time or when you're not familiar, it takes away some of the impact that the theatrical, like the points where some of these extra scenes come in, they actually dilute some of the impact a little bit. It takes an edge off. So it's great for when you're a fan of it, for the extra content and the lore and all that. But I think for an entertainment point of view and the way the story is told, the way that Peter Jackson told it in the theatrical version is the one you should be watching.
Now, this might be coming from a place of the fact that I haven't seen the theatrical version. I've only seen the extended, but like, I'm so glad I'm not in charge of trying to, you know, edit this movie down to a 3-hour piece instead of a 4-hour one. Because I literally, like, you know, sometimes when I watch an overly long movie or even a 2-hour, 2.5-hour movie, sometimes I'm like, hey, look, you really could have trimmed 15 minutes and it's like, that could have been dropped, or that storyline, or these scenes, or that could have been made tighter. I like, and this is, this is going to be the best critique I can give of this film. I look back at the 4-hour bloody experience, adventure that I had, journey with this film, and I'm like, where would you start cutting? You know, like almost like reverse engineering. Like, how do I create a theatrical cut? I have no idea what, like, I don't know what the extended scenes are. I don't know what scenes played too long. My experience is with this extended version, and it is what it is. Like, I honestly would not know where to start in terms of
I get it. I'll point out some of the scenes. You've got the list here in front of you of some of these ones are added, and I'll tell you why they're probably better off being in the extended edition. But it might be hard for you to interpret because you haven't seen the theatrical. But so when you've got Saruman's death, right? In the theatrical, you don't see Saruman. So they get to Orthanc in the tower where it's all flooded, and Gandalf just reflects on the thing and saying he has no power and you don't really see him.
So you don't
get a conclusion really to that element.
It gets impaled. It's a whole thing.
but it's very jarring. So it takes away, I guess, there's a feeling of victory as you're starting this movie, and it's a finalization. Now, also what happens in the books is Saruman doesn't die until the very end, and he actually goes and attacks the Shire. And when you're watching it theatrically, if you've read the books, if you're watching the theatrical version, when you don't see Saruman and you don't see, you know, him dying in that moment kind of thing, you don't know if whether or not they're going to expand the story into the Shire and Saruman attacking the Shire at the end. If you've read the books, that's what you might be expecting. So this is a really not way of starting it and going, oh, where are they going to take it? Whereas when you have him die, that's not in the books. It doesn't happen that way. And so it's very jarring.
Oh, and then you're watching this and you're like, well, he's 100% dead. Like, he's dead.
Yeah.
So then that's so not going to happen.
Yeah. But it's a beautiful scene in the way that you get like the empathy from King Theoden, and like he's forgiving, you know, Saruman's offside of Worm Tongue, like Grima. You know, he's saying, like, come down. Like, he's showing, even though he was corrupting the king in the second, you know, for years kind of thing, you get to see that element of that character, like, going, like, rising above that. So it is a really good addition, but it would take the jarring nature of him dying and stuff, it would take it away, right? Another thing, so you got Gandalf facing off with the Witch King, and he has his staff broken, right? Like, during the battle of the Minas Tirith battle. So that's not in the theatrical version. And for a really good reason, that's where in the extended edition, that's where you hear the horns of the Rohirrim who are about to, you know, they're arriving to save the day kind of thing. Now, the scene where that you hear that horn, it's not as if it's being like, so in the extended edition, the way it's portrayed is as if that horn's saving Gandalf, but it isn't that. It's actually more of an emotional point of, the battle's being lost, and you see, so it's more about, it's connected to the battle itself, not Gandalf. So it's just, it adds to it. It's really cool. But when you're watching it without, you know, when you're watching the theatrical cut, you're actually more on the, I don't know. It's just, I think Peter Jackson did it the right way in to have the right emotional points. That's the way, I guess, what I'm trying to articulate.
No, so. That is quite interesting, especially, yeah, it's just like what you include, what you don't include, it can change, obviously, what you're experiencing and expecting. And it's very interesting. Very interesting.
Some things, like the extended edition, though, some things I wish were in the theatrical, which I think would have been, I don't know why they're cut. So can you remember at the end of the Battle of the Pelennor Fields, and you got Eomer, like Carl Urban, when he finds Miranda Otto on the ground?
Yeah, so he screams.
He screams. Like, now, that's in the trailers, but it wasn't in the theatrical cut. And I remember going, where is that scene? Because it is incredibly well acted, like beautiful, just, you know, tragic. but it's not actually in the theatrical cut. So that's one of the ones. So there's some things in the extended edition where you're like, what? Why is that? Yeah, why'd they do that? But ultimately, I think most of them are for the right reasons, I'd say. So anyway, this has been extended edition conversation quarter. But I mean, let's talk about the movie, like, I guess, right? So, I mean, oh, hang on. Did you have anything else you wanted? I was talking a lot there. Do you want to add anything to that? Or
no, let's just talk about the movie that I did watch. let's do it. Yeah. Let me start us off because I think we've just to give your vocal cords a bit of a break. So what's good as we get into this third film,
yeah,
you know, we're on a 4-hour journey to the finish line. We've got three main storylines that we're following. We've got characters in different pockets of, you know, Middle Earth or wherever the hell they are specifically. But let's break it down here, and then I guess I don't know, we'll just talk about what's going on. So obviously, like, we're following the ring, we need to get it to Mordor, we need it to burn in the flames of
Mount Doom,
all of that. So Frodo, Sam, they're heading to Mordor with Gollum. And it's basically it's Gollum versus Sam in, like, the love for Frodo. Gollum's planning to betray them, kill them, steal the ring, put them in a stew. It's all that. There's basically, you've got the two hobbits really starting to struggle in terms of, like,
just
staying alive, making it, you know, walking. It's too much. Frodo particularly is obviously being very affected by the ring. It's really weighing him down. Sam is like, I want to wear the burden, and it's like, no, it's my burden to wear. Blah blah blah. Okay, we'll get back to them. The next story, we've got Gandalf and Pippin travel to Gondor to prepare for the coming war. And that's all the. That's like at the place. What's it called? Like the
Minas Tirith.
The thing of kings or leaders or whatever the hell it's called.
Gondor, the White City. So Minas Tirith is the name of the thing, the big circular city that's on the mountain, right?
And you've got what's his name's dad,
John Noble.
There
he plays what's his bloody name? Denethor. Look, I hate that guy. he's got the worst eating hygiene ever.
he's just pretty crazy. He's pretty crazy in this.
I've seen more rational people before. Yes, certainly.
Like this is sidetracking from like the point of what I make, but like the bit where like what's his name? Is it Faramir? I want to say not Boromir, Faramir.
What's
like,
his name?
Where he's like. He's not awake. He's not dead, but it's like my other son is dead. I've got nothing. Like, and it's like we must burn his body. I have no idea why does he think he's dead. Like, what is going on there?
He's not sane. He's insane at that point.
It's crazy.
And I tell you what, when he dies and he's burning. I mean, it's obviously unrealistic. He runs like. You know, may as well have run a fucking half marathon to, you know, on fire. But just the cinematic element of, you know, him burning and then running off the cliff. And then, you know, you get Gandalf saying, you know, like, you know, so passes Denethor, son of, I can't remember his name. But you're like, he deserved that.
There's a lot of good moments. Just go for it. There's a lot of good moments, like the battle sequences in this location is pretty cool. I think the like with both Pippin and also like Merry, like they're on different journeys, but kind of similar. Like they're basically like, hey, hobbits are stepping up and proving themselves and contributing, doing their thing, and like proving everyone wrong, which is great. And with Pippin, you know, like you get Billy Boyd's, you know, like little song sequence and all that. Like, I hope that's in the theatrical cut as well. But,
no, it is. It is. Yeah, it is. Yep.
Like that's in this, and there's a few things going on. All right, the third main core storyline: Theoden, Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas muster the Rohan forces to march to the aid of Gondor. So, with all this, we've basically got. The preparation, the lead in, and then the execution of, like, I guess, like the big epic like war battle scenes, which is cool. I mean, you know, you get the big elephants, you've got, you know, like the ghost pirates. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool. yeah, so you're getting the other side of yeah. stuff here. And I think it is good to get, you know, like the trio of particularly like Aragorn, Gimli and Legolas, like that's carried through since Fellowship, their friendship. And it's also like, you know, the coming together of man, elf and dwarf.
Yeah. You got like, the, you got the coming together of the world, basically like the world is collecting.
Through them.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, you've got Aragorn's journey. Like it's already been set up. Like they've been hinting at it that it's like, you know, like he needs to
step up,
Step up and be the king that, like, you know, he's heir to. So all that going on. Obviously within that storyline, we've also got, forgive me, the name of the blonde girl, the only other female that's not an elf.
Miranda Otto's character.
Miranda Otto's character, yes, that one. Her with Mary as well. Like
Eowyn is her name, by the way, but yeah, that's fine. I forgive you. Continue. So
isn't Eowyn the elf?
That's Arwen.
Oh mate. Well, you can see my issue there. No, but like both her and too many hobbits. Mary, like they kind of have the same kind of dilemma, and then I guess little journey where it's like oh no, the battlefield is no place for a woman. It's no place for a hobbit, and like together they kind of find a bit of a kinship where it's like, you ride with me, let's go, let's do it. You know, and they're kind of trying to stay out of the way, but at the same time being like, no, we are going to fight. With Mary, it's, I want to help my friends. Like this, despite like Miranda Otto's character, and that's just what I'm going to call her. Like in this film, look, there's not that many female characters as we're aware throughout this trilogy, but how they handle like her stepping up and being like, no, like I can contribute and do just as much on the battlefield and fight. Like what the movie's delivering through her character, I'm like, bang on. Like they handle it with so much care. It's not preachy. Yeah. It's not like in your face about it. It's like, it's just her just being like, no, I want to fight. Like I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And then she does it. Mm. And it's like, sweet. Yeah. It's great. Anyway, they're the three main stories. Mm. Dive into it, man. Go for gold. I'll see you back.
Well, I was going to say, what I like is how the movie, just like it was in the Two Towers, you know, it breaks it into, you got your core characters all split into different things and they're all doing different stuff. And I like that. I like where you've got, because it's different pacing elements. So things can get really intense and then you'll be cutting to a different group and you know, it's like a reprieve, you know, like it was in the second movie. But for this movie, the way that Peter Jackson's kind of crafted it, is there's certain things will happen that will link the three different storylines together in real time, which begins that process of bringing them together and culminating into, you know, this big battle and this big moment in their histories. Like, an example is, so when you've got Frodo and Sam and Gollum, they're climbing the stairs, or they're about to climb up the stairs of that mountain, right? And they're at that city and the big army is walking out. It's called Minas Morgul, I think is the name of the city. But you get the big green light that launches into the sky, right? And they're right there at that moment. But then it immediately cuts to Gandalf and Pippin, who are in Gondor, who are across the mountain range, and they see it as well. And they're connected. They are in that moment two completely separate storylines, and they have been for the duration of two movies now. But they're together. They're like, they're experiencing something together. And I think it's just a really interesting way of just like unconsciously kind of keeping everybody in check with where everybody is. Like, and Gandalf says it in that moment. He goes, well, it's in the trailer as well. It's a fantastic trailer. It says like, you know, the board's set, the pieces are moving. And it's that moment where the green thing's going, you know, and we come to it at last, the great battle of our time is one of the lines. But he's saying that to Pippin, but you as a viewer are getting to see that the pieces are moving. The fellowship is moving around this world, but but they're coming to the final game. They're coming to the final end of it all. And they're all connected in different ways. Another example is when they're at the Black Gate and, you know, Frodo's and Sam are dealing with Gollum and trying to throw the get rid of the ring, and the rest of them are all together and doing one last stand, but it's happening in unison, you know. Yeah, the way they tell the story, it's going backwards and forwards, and it's all connected.
And like, they don't even know.
They have faith. They don't know if Frodo and Sam are alive, but they've got faith that they are, and so at the same time they're doing what they can to help Frodo and Sam without even realizing if they're even alive or anything, you know. And that, I think, is just, that's where it just builds to this momentum. And it is such an amazing finale for these characters, because they're all battling in their own ways with this, you know, to try to overcome it all in their own little battles and their own little challenges. And I just think it's brilliant.
And you know, I think, like, with the scope of things, I think it might have been, and it might have been as a result of, you know, obviously talking about these films with you and really dissecting them, you know, getting more out of you than I do out of my wife, which happens more often than you think about it. But like in this most recent viewing, just really understanding or getting a better concept of how much time is actually passing, you know, like really listening to things where, like, you know, like Gandalf says, like, you know, I'm going to be, or like, we need to go there. And it's like, oh, you know, it's a 5-day walk or something or whatever, whatever it might be. That might not even be accurate, but you know, they'll say stuff like that. And then the next time you see them, they've then arrived at that place or something. You're like, oh, okay, wow. All of that time has passed.
Yeah.
Like, it's really taking them that long to travel. And then you kind of understand a little bit more of, like, oh, wow, that's why Frodo and Sam look like shit. Like, they're really like, and they don't wear shoes. So it's like,
but they've been out there in the wilderness, like, starving and all of that for, you know, I think the movie, it goes over, it's 13 months worth of time from the start to finish.
Just this movie or the
Frodo says it. No, Frodo says it to Sam.
He
rubs his shoulder. He goes, 13 months since he got stabbed by on Weathertop in the Fellowship of the Ring. He got stabbed in the shoulder by that blade. So 13 months passed in this journey.
You can still feel it.
Oh, man. Yeah. It's very...
No, very... I mean, it's just that understanding of the epic scope, and it's like, wow, this is bigger. Yeah. But I think it all just comes down to, I don't know, just being able to just really grasp it more. You pay attention and you can really, really to feel the journey of all of these characters and they come together. And again, I think it just makes for a more satisfying ending and conclusion for you. Like, you don't just get to be like, wow, that was a slog of a 12-hour journey I just had. It is more of like, wow, these characters really been through it, and I've been on the journey with them.
This movie, my perspective, right, I've seen this elsewhere, but I don't know if it's kind of, so the movie's called Return of the King, and clearly that's about Aragorn stepping up and becoming the king again, right? But Each of these three storylines and these characters, like Frodo being like the key character of the Frodo Sam Gollum element, you've got Gandalf being the key thing at Minas Tirith before the battle and stuff, and you got Aragorn with, you know, Gimli and that, you know, as they're with the Rohan guys. They're all becoming like, they're all stepping up into their own ways. Like, they're all becoming kings in the way. And what I mean by that is, you got Aragorn becoming a king, right, and taking on that responsibility. You got Gandalf, who's always been wise and everything like that, but he ends up by having to defend an entire city because the king there can't do it, and he ends up by having to lead the entire defense of everything. So he's become, you see that character step up and take on this huge responsibility. Of clearly he's up for it, he's a fucking wizard, but you just see him in a different light. Like, he's always been, like, he always comes at the right time to save the day and that kind of stuff. But this is him where he's
arrives exactly.
But he's now had to take that on and then be in charge of everybody, not just come and save the day kind of thing. And then you got Frodo, who's like, you see, you know, through this movie, you really see like the actual, even just the weight of the ring, like what it's doing to his brain kind of thing. But even just the physical weight of it, like, it becomes heavier as it goes on. And like, you see the chain, like you see the cuts in his neck from the chain because it's so heavy, and the emotional impact of, you know, feeling like Sam's betrayed him because he's being manipulated, and and then he ends up.
It really does convey, like, there's no pun here, but not intentionally anyway, the power of the ring, like, and it really sells the fact that it's like there's something, like there's like an act, like a being. There is a persona to the ring. There's a character in it, and it's affecting.
Well, I read
doing things.
I read something somewhere. I can't remember where, and it was quite a while ago, right? But like it's weird when you think about it. Like Sauron, he had so much faith that ring was so powerful and corrupting that he didn't post. Like, if you were worried about the ring being destroyed, you would have had an army waiting at the mountain to stop anybody from throwing it in, right? But he had so much faith in its ability to corrupt people that wasn't a concern of his. He never expected it to get to that point when you think about it, because he's clearly focusing on everybody else, and he just doesn't expect it. It's just too powerful. Yep. And then you see Frodo overcoming it, but barely. And at the end, actually, if you think about it, Frodo, you know, he takes on all that weight, and him and Sam, like they, you know, Sam has to pick him up and drag him. Like, they both step up to get to this challenge, both pretty much reflecting that they're not even going to make it. They don't even have enough food to do a return journey. They're not even going to do it. They need to finish the task and accept that they're not going to do anything. But then Frodo succumbs to it. Like, that's a fantastic way of finishing that, is he didn't actually succeed when he's, you know, taken it on, and he didn't succeed in his mission. It fell into the thing because by an accident. And that in itself shattering. Yep. Yeah, like, Frodo didn't succeed, and neither did Sam. It was through the ring's corruption that it destroyed itself, you know, that kind of thing. So that's how powerful the ring is.
The film, the story doesn't lean into Frodo just being like this perfect heroic thing. Like, obviously, you know, beside, you know, the actual struggles with the ring and stuff, but take the scene like with the big, like, spidery things. Like, that's a scene where, you know, Sam's not there. Like, it's just Frodo. So it's like, all right, cool. Is Sam going to rock up and save the day, or is Frodo going to get out of this himself? And, you know, there's a point where, like, he's immobilized. Like, he's wrapped up in the spider's web. Like, he's about to get it done, and he manages to get out of it, but he still stuffs up.
Yeah.
And then, so it's like Sam does come into it and, like, kind of saves the moment, but then at the same time Sam kind of F's up and gets taken away. So it's like they both have their moments to shine, and then I think that's delivered even further when they do get to you know, like, Mount Doom, and it's like Frodo can't go any further.
Physically can't do it.
But Sam's like, I will carry you.
Oh, how good is that scene and the music?
It's good. And even like you mentioned you know, like, Frodo's there, he just has to let go of the ring, but he can't do it because the ring's just too strong for him. Like, and he's defeated in that. And it's only because Gollum interferes, tries to, you know, because of his corruption, like you said, and then it ends up in there because he falls in there with it. So it's like, yeah, Frodo didn't even put it in there, but either way, managed to do it. So all good.
Oh God, I just thinking about it gives me a little goosebumps. I mean, and I know, so I obviously I love this movie, right? But just, can you remember? Just think back, like when Frodo's wrestling Gollum at the end there, and they both fall off the edge, and then Frodo's holding on to Sam's hand, and he's just like, the look in, like, Elijah Wood's face, the way he just portrays the utter defeat, you know, like he lost to the ring, it overcame him, and at the end it still works out, but he just, like, you know, he just thinks of letting go, like, you can see it, and, like, Sam's like saying, "Don't you dare let go," and, like, you just, it's just pure defeat. Like Frodo's got nothing left. And you're like, far out. Like, what do you go through? All of it. It's the way, like, Elijah Wood is. How did he not get a bloody Academy Award for this? He's incredible.
Oh, he makes some interesting faces in this movie. Now
he certainly does. He certainly does. So some of them aren't that great. You're right. But I just think it's a brilliant performance. Like, just pure. Like, you just feel hopeless for him. I feel anyway. I think he's just got that look in his eyes. Like we said, we mentioned it in the Fellowship of the Ring review. Like he was chosen by Peter Jackson for his the way he has like this sorrow, tearful look in his eyes. Like when he leaves, left the mines of Moria when Gandalf died, and he just looks at the camera and like he is just all hope has gone for him, and he's just just despair.
Like
And just the way he does that, you know, oh, it's beautiful. It's great stuff. Anyway.
Do you want to be alone with your thoughts?
this movie lives rent free in my head, mate. It just really does. So with it, like, so with the three storylines that we're talking about, they all culminate, and you get everybody gets to step up and do their own thing. Like Pippin gets to, you know, he gets to fight on in the battle with Gondor, and Gandalf leads the charge. Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas and Theoden, like them coming to the rescue. Them making a decision to be involved and bring that whole nation, you know, into the fight to try to save the other. And the, you know, you got Theoden's story as well around from the Two Towers, how he was trying to get redemption. He felt he thought he was a failed king. And then this is his moment. And like when just before, you know, the Rohirrim charge into the Battle of Pelennor Fields or and all that kind of stuff. The speech that he gives to everybody, where he's saying, like, you know, it's going to be a a day of blood, and you know, we're off to die, basically. But he's proud, like he's proud, and these people are proud to put themselves in that position and let it all go. They know that they're going to almost certain death, but they know it's worth it. And just that kind of stepping up of that moment, is very. For that character, I think is brilliant. Mm. It's brilliant. You know, tragically, he also doesn't make it at the end of it all. And you get such a beautiful moment with that character. Not only do you see him excel at the start of that battle, you know, as that king that he wanted to be, and the people follow him and just, you know, disregard for their own, you know, their own lives and safety because it's there's a bigger purpose there. But when he does, you know, when he's killed, he has a moment before he dies when he's talking to Eowyn and or Miranda Otto for you, Jace. Sorry, and then he goes, but he acknowledges that, you know, he wasn't expecting to see her, but then he, you know, it's a kind face as he's dying, kind of thing, and it's a beautiful moment. But he says, you know, I can go now, and you know, we're my forefathers, and I won't be ashamed anymore. And you're like, and then that's a the conclusion of his arc, he dies, and I couldn't see it done any better than that. It's brilliant.
Can I ask you a question about his character?
Yeah.
What's with his beard?
The question. Green.
Why is his beard green? Well, I actually got to a point where, like, because I'm terrible with names, unless it's like Frodo or
Bernard Hill.
Yeah.
Captain Smith from Titanic. That's who Bernard Hill is. Yeah.
Speaking of Cap, I mean, I started just calling him Captain Greenbeard. Like when I refer to him. No, it's weird. His not all the time, but just sometimes his beard would just turn green. It's like a yellowy greeny color. Anyway, I'm sorry. I don't know what the hell to deal with
there. Well,
the
thing is what you're pointing out, like I don't disagree. Like, I don't think I've really paid that much attention to it, but I think it actually is like there's a lens filter, like cinematography decision.
I was like, is it green screen, like reflection? Anyway, it's not.
They didn't do much green screen in this movie, you know? Right. Actually, you know what? That's a really good segue because I could, in all seriousness, I could talk for longer than the extended edition of this freaking movie about this movie.
And we can't.
Right?
We
can't do that. We can't. No, and I just recommend people watch the thing and get as passionate as I am, and then you'll understand. But the segue, though, special effects, like in all three of these, you know, these movies and the reviews that we've done for this trilogy, you know, we have commented on the special effects that have been employed, you know, for this trilogy. And at the time, and even now, you know, to some degree, we're just groundbreaking. Just unheard of things, you know, and it's all kind of really thanks to, you know, the New Zealand based company, you know, Weta Digital and the works that they did, you know, with their motion capture stuff, but then you've got the massive software. We talked about this in the other review. The software that they created that simulates individual units on a battlefield that you can increase the scope to, you know, unheard of, you know, digital simulation of individuals within armies to a degree that had never been seen before. Now, in the Two Towers, you had 10,000, you know, Uruk-hai orcs attacking Helm's Deep in that big base. Here, like, the Battle of Minas Tirith and the Pelennor Fields and all of that, it was meant to be 50,000 individual units, and the scope went up to 200,000, and they achieved that. And you can see that, like, it's unfathomable how they managed to do it in 2003. And like you said, you know, some things haven't quite aged as well as, like, you know, but some things really just, like, some like those army scenes, for example, they the Rohirrim charging over the hill, that's 6 or 7,000 horses, individual horses, using this massive software that's created, you know, by Weta. It just looks great. It looks incredible. And even now, even today, now, like, in 2024, it looks amazing.
To give some honest critique and praise for all of that, like, you're sitting here telling me that, like, a lot of that was computer generated. There's this program that's, like, duplicating images to make it seem obviously larger in scale, all of that. Like, I sat here watching, and I already mentioned, you know, there's some certain shots or sequences where I'm like, yeah, very cartoony. Oh, that's definitely a CGI image. You know, it doesn't look great. Still not the worst, but, like, just doesn't look great. There's so much of what you just said, I'm like, that wasn't really, they weren't really horses. They weren't actually, that there weren't that many people there. Like, there's so many sequences that you just referenced there. I'm like, I thought they filmed that. Like, I thought that was real.
So, I mean,
so, and like, that is mind blowing, man. It's crazy.
Really,
the proof's in the pudding. You mentioned all the awards and stuff that it was, you know, nominated for and won so many.
Mm.
I mean, a big chunk, and it isn't necessarily a bad thing at all, but a big chunk of the awards that it did win were, you know, like,
technical
special
based.
Effects, yeah. Film, tech-based sound, all that kind of stuff.
Mm.
You know, all the behinds, the post-production kind of work, it's all there.
Well, and that's something that, I guess,
it's fantastic.
I don't think people reflect on it as much. You know, when you're talking about this trilogy, not just this movie, but the trilogy as a whole, most of the time you're generally talking about the characters and the impacts and, like, the journey that they're on and how your emotional connection to them and all the stakes.
Yeah, the story, yeah.
But the technical artistry in this film, and like we said, that's the most of the awards that it won was around the technical elements. It didn't actually win acting awards. But it's the craft, it's the way this film was made, the cinematography of this movie, like, and the way that the camera chooses the scenery. Like, if you think, like, those scenes when Frodo and Sam are climbing up that staircase, which is a cliff, basically. But they're all those elevated, you know, shots that kind of pan and rotate around, so you can see them, but you can see how high they've traveled and that full scene underneath them. It's just that angle it's daunting what they've had to do to get to where they are, and they're still just they're on their way. They're still just continuing on. The way that
there's so much, like, that's put into this movie that makes it feel like. Is like, and I say this in a nice way, like, did they make a set, like, in this real location? Like, because things are looking that real. And again, there are some shots where you've got characters standing and there's this beautiful background and it's clearly like, okay, they've superimposed a particular background or framing or something for whatever. You can tell that's, like, they're not actually there. It's very rare that happens in this movie because obviously they're on location as much as possible, and you have so many great, like, just shots of, like, the New Zealand landscape, mountains and snow and forestry and, like, water areas and things. It's just like it's crazy, and it's just like it really, like, you know, since that first film, like a world truly has been created, and it's just using those elements, like just real film techniques to just like bring this all together again. Like you said, like, yeah, look, it's not winning awards for its actors' performances and all that kind of stuff, but that's not what these movies are. Like, like the performances and stuff are perfectly fine enough to convey the story that we've got, you know, like it's almost like a pantomime, a play, like it's a theatrical thing. It's an experience. It's that we're getting performances and we're getting, you know, like story told through these characters and all of that. Yeah, then, you know, it's not, we're not sitting there being like, wow, that's a groundbreaking performance that, you know, like bring them into tears. But it's like, you know, we're on this journey and we're invested regardless of all that. And it works. It's a different sort of kettle.
Like, well, I agree. And I think, you know, one of the unspoken or the underrated elements of this, or maybe underappreciated or recognized, whatever, I'm sure how to articulate it is, but they created, like you said, this, the landscape and everything, the cinematography and the way they created this movie and made Middle Earth, they created Middle Earth. You can watch that movies in this setting without those characters, and you will still have a connection to these movies. And what I mean by that, like when you watch the Hobbit trilogy, they're using the same locations, the same geography in just different ways, and you immediately feel connected. You immediately
it's its own character,
and between, you know, the special effects and how they, you know, create these big battles and stuff, but just how they frame these shots and the scope and the way that they capture it all, it's just a beautiful thing that, and it's been emulated, it's been, you know, repeated again with, you know, the rest of the franchise, and even in the TV show. I mean, this first season of it was shot in New Zealand. And again, you're re-entering into the world, and the world itself has come alive because of this trilogy, and it's been expanded into all these different things. It isn't just about Frodo and Aragorn. It's about that world. And that's a connection that people, I think, maybe even unconsciously, they don't realize that they've got a connection to that world as well as these characters. I think it's very well done. Very, 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 very well done. What about the, you know, you got one thing to have, you know, places on cameras and cameras panning around everywhere. But it's the other thing that I think just needs to be shouted out, and I don't know if it actually does get shouted out enough, is like the music from Howard Shore for this. It's just...
You know what? It finally happened. You know how, like, I think when we talked about the first two movies, and I was like, yeah, no, like the music sounds really good, but like it hasn't registered in me yet, but like... Mm. When the wife and I were, you know, in anticipation for this specific review today, like, we went back and did the trilogy again. And I think by the end of the second film, like, I was just in the kitchen doing something, and I was just humming to myself, and she was like, "You're a loser." She's like, "Yes." Like, almost like I had been converted because I was humming. I can't remember which one it was. It might have just been, I think it was probably like Aragorn's theme whenever he shows up, and it's just, I was like, yep, I've finally done it.
Yeah.
I'm into it. So, sorry, I interrupted your break into the music there. But
so what you're saying there, you know, I mean, I resonate with that. So I have on my Spotify, I've got a Spotify playlist just for movie themes. And a lot of them are Lord of the Rings themes. Because you've got standout, like, so one of the things I wrote here just in prepping, so there's over 50 different motifs that were created by Howard Shore, but there's a few standouts. And for this movie, like, he's done it for all three, but this movie in particular, you know how we're saying we've got the three branch storylines with the groups of characters doing different things, but they're all kind of connected. He weaves the different themes for the different characters and locations into each other. And it's fucking incredible. Like, it's not only is it
like it's not just
emotive, it's personal. It's personalized for that. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah. It's like it's not just like, okay, this scene is, we've got Sam and Frodo. Okay, we're gonna play the Shire theme.
or a version of it or whatever. And then, okay, now this scene is these characters who will play, you know, the Gondor theme or something. It's okay. This scene is like, it cuts to then these characters in this scene, but then the music like carries over into the next scene. And then it transitions into, as you said, it weaves into the other motif, into something. And I noticed that, but I think particularly in this one, more so in this film. And I was just like, this is really cool. It's almost like what, like I've seen on YouTube and stuff, like, you know, fans of certain movies, they would go in and, you know, cut together some music and essentially do that because they're like, wouldn't it be so much cooler if the, you know, these themes of these characters, take like Avengers Endgame, for instance, they're like, what if everyone's theme played when they appeared on screen? And I've seen like a cut where, and it's like, hey, it's actually pretty cool. It's kind of fun. Obviously, like the Alan Silvestri like score in that moment is epic, but it's like, it's an interesting thing. He does that in this film. And I'm like, I like that. It's cool.
I think
very seamless. It's pretty.
It really is seamless, and it's sometimes it's so subtle as well. Like you have, you know, the Gondor theme, which I think is the theme you're talking about with Aragorn.
It's the music that plays every time he rocks up.
for the most part, but depending on, you know, where they are, if they're in Gondor, but they might be with, like, it might be focusing on the interaction between Gandalf and Pippin, but they're in Gondor. So you get, like, you've just gone from this sweeping Gondor theme, maybe as you're seeing the city. And then as, you know, you're listening to Gandalf and Pippin talk, you get the little Hobbit little flute thing popping up in there, but then it's still the Gondor theme overall, but it just links it. It's fantastic.
I'm probably thinking more, I think I'm thinking the Fellowship theme.
I think that's what you are. Yeah,
it's usually the trio. It's usually the trio that are doing something, and but because Aragorn's usually at the front of that, I'm like, it's the Aragorn music. Aragorn's back, yeah. Woo!
But I think it is, the Fellowship theme you're talking of.
Yeah.
That's so good. I could just listen to that all day, every day. And you know, I mean, we've talked, you know, endlessly about scores and how we really enjoy a film score through, you know, the different movies we've reviewed, and like John Williams and Alan Silvestri and Hans Zimmer, like these are all favorites. But Howard Shore, like, this is his magnum opus. Like he's done such good work in so many different areas. But this, I'd have to say, this score, it's probably one of, if not the greatest score that's ever been made for a freaking movie. Just its technical brilliance and the way that it links, like that storytelling, I guess, capacity and how it complements everything. It's just, I think it's an absolute masterpiece. A lot of things are very more individualized for, you know, their film and that kind of thing. And they're brilliant, undisputably. But just what's happened with this movie and this the way Howard Shore's created it, I can't even articulate how in awe I am of it.
It's very good. I will say, like, genuinely, like, it's a good score. Like, for me myself, like, and I guess maybe because I don't have that emotional investment and connection with this, so like it's a brilliant score. It's fantastic. So I don't want to downplay it. I just can't say it's one of the greatest ever, but
I just respectfully agree to disagree on this one, because for me personally, because I don't, you know, clearly not everyone is as enthusiastic about this movie as maybe I would be, you know, but there's this, like, it's a goosebump score for me. Like,
it's beautiful music. It really is glorious. So again, I don't want to downplay in any sort of way. It's just, for me, I'm just like, it's not the greatest, but I'm allowed to say that.
Of course you are. And I reckon some people might listen to this episode and agree with both of us. Like, yeah, you know what I mean?
Music,
like,
shit.
Someone might be like, what the fuck do I care about the music so much? Or like, yeah, you tell them, Jason.
I hope people listen. I hope people listen to this and just go, I hate these guys.
They probably are.
Not even from anything we're saying specifically today. They're just listening to me. Man, I hate these guys so much.
I fucking hate it. I can't believe I subscribe to this and I keep on listening to it every time it comes out. What I would say to you is, congratulations for getting this far in this episode. Well done. That's what I'd say to you. Look, like I said just a little bit ago, I could talk for longer than what these movies' runtime actually is because I'm so into it. But we do have to draw a line. You know, we're gonna draw a line in the sand.
There is actually an extended version of this podcast episode. it is literally just an extra 3 hours of Rob just talking to himself because I just left.
He just went on mute. If anyone wants to reach out to me and then just go crazy fanboy over this shit, by all means, send me a...
Yep. This is Rob's personal number. What?
What's our area code here in Australia? +61.
I'll work it out.
They'll work it out. You could probably find me somewhere anyway. Anyway, look, we need to wrap it up. But before we do give our little score... I've got a list of standout scenes. There's quite a long list, so I'm not going to say. I'm just going to pick one for me, like that always gives me goosebumps. That I just, I could even just not watch the movie and just watch this scene, and I'll feel fulfilled. And that would be the rider there here, like as all the horses are charging in that moment, that speech. I reckon if we're talking standout scenes and everything, that to me there's. It's incredible. It's perfect. Looking at this list in front of you, Jace, or from your experience, do you have anything that you would just say out of such a brilliant movie and all this, what a standout, something that jumps out and just goes, geez, that was good?
I mean, there's you compiled a good list, and it's made me think of like things that we haven't really touched on, like the movie opening with the turning of, Spiegel and stuff. Yeah. And we actually get, what's his name? The guy.
Gollum's. Oh, Andy Serkis. You actually see him as
Andy Serkis. That's what. Mine's blanking. I've literally got a list of all the names, and I'm like, yeah, you tell me. It's easy. you see his face, and it's turning like his story with his brother and stuff. Like, delving into all that. This list that you've got, it's just made me think of like different things in the movie that we didn't really touch on. But look, when I look back and I'm like, what? Because the movie's so grand and so epic, like there's so many moments and sometimes it's like a whole sequence. It could be this particular battle or this interaction or more quieter moments, like, or relationship, Aragorn and, Miranda Otto, like they're sort of dancing around something there, but then, he's also, battling internally, his connection with, Arwen. I want to say
Liv Tyler.
Arwen, Liv Tyler. Yeah, let's just use actor names. That's better. and then you've got her, like, and her dad. Old Agent Smith there. Talking about stuff and
Hugo Weaving. Yeah.
Look, there's just so many like small moments matched with big, epic, grand things, and then of course like bits that stand out. You've got. Characters screaming at each other, Gollum and Sam going at it, and Sam Frodo, telling Sam to sod off pretty much.
Heartbreaking.
And then, and of course, as we keep going back to it, you remember Frodo standing there with the ring, and Sam's being like, "You just got to throw it in, Mr. Frodo," and it's just do it, man. And then when it is done, it's like. It's done.
Yeah.
It's done. And, it's memed and, I think we've sent it back to
each other. Yeah.
Every time we've like finished like preps for these episodes, it's done. I don't know. There's so many moments. And to be fair, like, I'll be honest, when I watch the trilogy, it starts to blur what scene was in The Two Towers and what scene was in this one.
That's actually a good point as well. I kind of don't. Sometimes it blurs with me as well. Because usually when I watch these movies, I watch them together. Not in a marathon, but very close together, Just like you did, you and Beck have done. And it is quite easy to... get lost in the overall journey because they actually do flow very well into each other.
Do you know what? I think overall, just to cap it, and then we can do our rating. I think I really, as much as there's all the action and the dead bodies and the killing and pillaging and all that, I love that at the center of all of this, like, you've got the story of your hobbits and them again stepping up and proving something. And I think it is all, there's a really great sense of like fulfillment when you get Aragorn at the end and he says, you bow to no one.
Oh, it's good.
And it really, like, it's just everything that means, like the respect of like, hey, look, like you four, like the fact that they're bowing in the first place, because they're like, look, he's a king. We bow. It's what we do.
Mm.
And then he just says, like, nope, not you guys. You don't do that because you're above that. Like, and basically saying, you guys have proven yourselves like
more than anything. Yeah.
And it's just, I don't know. There's so much to just that simple line. And it just really sums up that whole aspect of this trilogy, like with those characters and doing their things. Like, a hobbit can make a difference.
I don't think I can watch that scene without like a little tear in the eye, like, and little, and goosebumps.
Because you're a bitch.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it is pretty magical. It's
a beautiful moment. And the score, obviously, like, really, really helps. Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah.
And that's why it's also all the more daunting when it's like, after that, it's like, back to the Shire. Mm. And, it's like, okay. And then what? What's next? And it's, you got Frodo, doing his part of the book. It's just, like, and again, so much time has then since passed, and it's just like, wow, after an adventure that epic, what happens? And it is, it's something.
Sometimes you can't go back from it. I mean, which is exactly what does happen. He saved the world, but he didn't save it for him. It's too late for him, it's very bittersweet stuff. Actually, another standout thing I'd want to just reflect on as well. The Rohirrim Chargers, that's a standout scene for me, and it's just probably my favorite thing in the whole trilogy. But there's that moment with Sam and Frodo after they've destroyed the ring. It said, it's gone, all that. And then they have that moment of just that moment of regret where they're talking about what they would have liked to have done. And they're sitting on a rock, and the lava's floating around them. And then they've given up, but they haven't. No, they accepted. They basically accepted their fate
because they know that there's no way to get home. They didn't plan for that. They're just like, nope, we do what we need to do.
Sam talks about how he would have loved to have married that girl, and you just
so sweet.
It's beautiful, and you're just like, God, I wish you could have, mate. And then it happens, which is fantastic. It just makes that moment. That's one of the many endings. One of them is Sam's. He marries Rosie Cotton and he has kids and he gets to live his happy life, So I think, it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Also he thinks. Nah.
Anyway. In the book, I mean, this is irrelevant. I know we need to wrap up, but in the book, he actually ends up being the mayor of the.
Oh, sorry, what?
He becomes the mayor of the Shire and has like seven kids or something. And I think he ends up by catching the boats to go to the Grey Havens at the end as well, like when he's an old.
Oh.
I think they all do. I think all of them go over. Don't quote me on that specifically. I don't know that.
Nah, I like how it was a Bilbo. It was a Bilbo thing.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
It's just like, let him move on. And he was so much older now.
He's ancient.
Yeah.
All right. let's just talk about what's our rating at it. So, out of five VHS tapes, Jason.
All right.
Can I go first? Because I'm not even going to harp on. I usually harp on, right? But I'm just saying, clearly this is a 5 out of 5 for me. So,
okay.
This is what it is. Literally, I've got two favorite movies. It's this movie and Jurassic Park. And this one is, a lot of the times, if I reflect on it, is it's higher up there than Jurassic Park. If I'm in the right mindset, definitely. Two very different times in life when like I'm watching them in different parts of my life. But this was as I was a young adult, so this has got a different lens. 5 out of 5, no debating it. If I could do 6 out of 5, Jason, I would. I'm afraid.
Wow. Well, that's not how scale works.
It is
funny how you can obviously your two favorites, one of the other ones being Jurassic Park. And look, let's call it what it is. On this show that we do, there's only 3 trilogies that we have now covered. And yes, I'm referring to the Jurassic Park trilogy as opposed to the Jurassic World movies. We did do Back to the Future as our special 50th episode. We covered all 3. But as individual episodes, 1 per movie, we've only done Jurassic Park, The Lost World, and Jurassic Park 3, and then the Lord of the Rings trilogy. So, I don't know, something interesting there. Obviously, Jurassic Park being my favorite. Clearly not yours, because whatever. I'm claiming it as my thing, and you think you can have this one. Anyway, so I just want to cover that. But it's good. But we've done it. We have now done the Lord of the Rings trilogy, so we can both die on a rock. and we're happy. It is done. No, look, I honestly can't remember what I ended up rating Fellowship and Two Towers, but whatever it is,
this one's better, this has
got to be a higher rating because I think out of the and to be honest, I used to always say like, Fellowship was always my favorite one because it just had, it was a nice setup. It was a journey. It was a nice, clean story. You had all the characters together. And then as I was watching the second one, I'm like, but there's so much more going on and the action is more intense. You've got all these new characters, but like they introduce them in such a good way. But then in this one, it's just, you've got these characters in different places. How it all sort of comes together without actually coming together. The battles are epic and stuff. There's so much going on. The music is great. I can ping this for a couple shoddy effects. I can ping this for, and I get it, we are watching the extended one, so a bit of a hard criticism, but I ping this for being just way too long. But at the same time, I said before, what the hell would I trim? I don't know. So like, I won't go crazy because I think I need to level it with my own personal enjoyment experience and what I get out of this. But there's so much appreciation. I need that to be communicated that it's like, look, I'm on board. I get it. These are great films. I'm going to come in at a 4.5. Don't hate me.
Oh, I could never hate you.
I was thinking before coming into this, I was like, I'm probably going to land about a 4, but it's one of those things when you talk through it all, it's like, there's really not much I can take off it, but I'll shed half a mark just because I'm a bit of a douche. So 4.5 out of 5. I'm sticking to it.
Mate, I accept it. I respect it. I wonder how well this is going to age, this this movie. Like, it's been 20 years and I think it's fantastic. I wonder what in another 20 years time when we're very old and gray, I wonder if we're still going to feel the same way.
This was a trilogy that people said that it was unfilmable. They can never film it.
Yeah.
And Peter Jackson proved them wrong by doing it. And some people will say like it's a perfect trilogy. Some will say like me, like, look, it's got some faults and here and there, but look, overall, like after watching it a few times and actually being able to follow the majority of the story and a lot of the more in-depth stuff with certain characters and like, oh, they're related to them, and it's like, okay, cool, like there's all that stuff happening. Like, look, it's a fantastic, it's a 12-hour little journey. I say little, obviously it's being sarcastic there. Like it's epic. It's crazy.
And
they pulled it off. They really pulled it off.
Yeah. Maybe it'll have a life like Star Wars, where you always, will reflect so positively on this, these 3 that are produced, and then other entries come into it that you're like, maybe not, maybe yes, maybe no, there's positives, negatives. But overall, there's a commitment for like continuity. Right now, the property doesn't have continuity with the different productions that are happening with it, right? But I would like to see in the long run, if more movies are produced in this kind of
in this universe that it is, it shares the same continuity as these movies to complement them and to complement and build the world even more. I would like to see that.
But I think a lot of people will look back and view these this trilogy as it's, and whether you include the Hobbit movies as well, which I think the general audience would, because they are literally connected. However, I think a lot of people would also just say, look, the Lord of the Rings trilogy is what it is. It is, it's, it, that is the thing. And all the high praise will go to the, these three films as what it is, like as the king. like I said it before, like this truly is, and again, it's not my genre, so I've got no dog in this race, but the Lord of the Rings trilogy is the peak of fantasy cinema.
Yeah.
You know, swords and battle, horses, wizards, all that kind of bullshit. It's
all that kind of bullshit indeed.
So like when will we see a fantasy film or series of films have as much influence and just achieve as much as the Lord of the Rings trilogy did?
I don't think we will.
Well, I mean, it'll happen eventually, surely.
Well, the property, it's been
20 years and it hasn't happened yet.
So. And there isn't a body of work that's comparable either. Like, you got the Wheel of Time stuff by Robert Jordan. That's formidable, but that's a TV show on Amazon, and it's not that good. It's okay. It's not that great. Game of Thrones, another very formidable body of work, but it's been done now. Like, it has had its moment, and it didn't exceed this. You know, like, so I don't know. Fantasy books, but I don't necessarily like the movies that well.
Whatever comes, but it doesn't need to be an adaptation of a fantasy book series to necessarily match.
No, it doesn't. It certainly doesn't, but it does help to have that fleshed out, you know, world to draw from already, I would say. Yeah. And part of that is, you know, Tolkien's works were so comprehensive that there was so much to draw from and create from that and expand on, you know. Did you know there's another Lord of the Rings movie coming out this year, but it's animated? It's about...
Oh, I think I heard something like that.
It's a prequel kind of thing set in this continuity, but animated. And it's based on the guy who... So, you know, the two towers with the Helm's Deep. The character is...
Yeah, sure.
The Helm is, you know, somebody Helm or something. So it's named after him. And it's narrated by John Rhys-Davies. Who was Gimli, the dwarf?
Ah.
Oh, no, hang on. No, sorry. It's got Miranda Otto. She was from...
I know her.
Yes. So, Miranda Otto is narrating it. So as a link to this property that we're, you know, there was a video game, a survival game that came out called Return to Moria this year. And that was narrated by John Rhys-Davies as Gimli. Very interesting.
Wow.
So the property...
There you go. And look, that just shows... The franchise, the IP, it's still relevant. There's still material around. It's all happening.
I will continue to consume it as it appears. Well, we say that about Jurassic Park as well, even though we are steadily steadily declining interest as that goes. But we'll see how the next iteration.
Those movies make bank.
They make some dollars, and Gareth Edwards doing the next one should be pretty damn amazing, I reckon. But that's just me because I like his work. Hey, guess what? We need to wrap this episode up. Hey, so ladies and gentlemen, that was our rewind to 2003's The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King. Wow.
Well, indeed. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Rewind and Review. Make sure you subscribe and download this podcast on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, wherever you can find us, and feel free to leave us a review.
Mm-hmm. Also, please follow us on social media. We're on Facebook at Rewind and Review Podcast, and Twitter, or X, I guess. Instagram is That Film Stew Podcast.
Stop trying to make X happen. My God. If you haven't already, check out our other shows, That Film Stew, and Sound Like... It's like I say this every episode.
Every episode.
Still stumbling. Let's try that again. Check out our other shows, That Film Stew and Sounds Like Comics. Each of those shows also have our own Facebook pages.
Yep. Thanks for listening, everybody. This has been another Rewind Review, and we will see you on our next trip.
Please rewind this cassette before returning it to your video library.